For Monday, February 12th, just to give you a roadmap of where we're headed for those watching in the room, we're going to do public hearings on 2361 and 2362 initially, and expect to go to work session on 2361. Then we'll then be holding the public hearing on 2514, which will be a public hearing only, even though the agenda says possible work session, and then proceed to 2233 and 2492 as time permits. So I will now open a public hearing on House Bill 2361.
Council Taylor. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2361 comes to you from the Oregon State Bar Estate Planning Section. The bill clarifies that for the purpose of determining if a distribution of an entity constitutes distribution of principal income, the determination is based on whether the entity distributes more than 20% of its assets, not whether the trust receives more than 20% of the assets distributed. Chair, members of the committee, this is as a result of a case down in California which held to the contrary. And their law is exactly the same as ours because it's a uniform law. You have representatives from the Oregon State Bar.
Mr. Wachter.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, my name is Tim Wachter. I'm chair of the Oregon State Bar's Executive Committee, the State Planning Administration Section. I'm in private practice in Portland. I note the testimony is prepared by Bill Brewer, also a member of the Executive Committee. I told him I would testify for him this morning. The bill is intended to correct some wording in the Oregon Uniform Principal Income Act, which is an act that governs a trustee's duties to allocate receipts of a trust between income and principal. Currently, if a trust or an estate receives a liquidating distribution from a company, it typically would allocate to the principal of the trust, whereas if it received dividends or other income, it would be allocated to the income. Under current Oregon law, if a trust that owns 20% of a company receives 20% of the value, it's a liquidation. If you have two trusts, they each receive 15%, it would be income because the trust hasn't received 20% of the value of the company. The purpose of the statute is to value the 20% based on the entire value of the company, not what the individual trust receives, and this is just to clarify the statute. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. Happy to answer any questions of the committee.
Are there any questions for this witness? I think that's going to be it, Mr. Rocker. Thank you for your presentation. I think it's pretty clear to me from what's happened here. I will close a public hearing on House Bill 2361 and open a work session on House Bill 2361. Colleagues, my reaction was that the existing statute should have been read the way this clarification would indicate, but apparently a court someplace has held otherwise. So we ought to put ourselves in a position where you don't have any concern about how that's being interpreted. So I would invite a motion to move this bill and to put it on the consent calendar.
So moved.
Representative Wisneth has moved House Bill 2361 to the floor with a due pass recommendation to be placed in the consent calendar. Is there any discussion of the motion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Morris?
Aye. House Bill 2361 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation to be placed on the consent calendar. I'll now close the work session on House Bill 2361 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2362.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2362 comes to you from the Oregon State Bar Section. It would allow probate proceedings to follow the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure concerning the verification of pleadings and allow pleadings to be sworn to and not required notarization. I should have said the Oregon State Bar Estate Planning Section. You have a set of amendments, the dash one amendments in front of you, and they go to page five of the bill. And simply what they do is they move the statement that's on line 30 through 32 up to line 14. You have a witness here from the Oregon State Bar ready to testify.
And we have two witnesses signed up, Mr. Wachter again and Warren Darris. Why don't you both come up, gentlemen? I'll let whoever you prefer to lead off.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Tim Wachter, Oregon State Bar, State Planning Section. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2362, which deals with, from the section's perspective, it is to bring certain Oregon probate rules to make them consistent with current practice in trial courts. Currently, under the Oregon Rules of Procedure, pleadings can be used with a declaration, and Mr. Darris will review the difference between declarations and affidavits, verifications a little bit later after my testimony. But currently, certain things have to be notarized, and this bill simplifies the probate process by using a declaration rather than notarization for certain documents. There is a second change in the bill. I just want to make sure it's not overlooked. And currently, if all the beneficiaries in the state administration consent and all creditors have been paid, the prisoner representative may submit a short form accounting to the probate court. When you submit a accounting to the court, that's when attorney fees are approved. So attorney fees are not paid until court approval and approval of the accounting. Under the current statute, all creditors need to be paid to use this procedure. The attorneys obviously are not paid yet because they're subject to court approval. The practice now is to go ahead and use the short form without attorney fees being approved and paid, and there's a change in here to make it clear that that's acceptable practice. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. Happy to answer any questions.
Why don't we hear from Mr. Darris, and we can open it up to questions.
Chairman McPherson, members of the committee, my name is Warren Darris. I'm an attorney in private practice in Oregon. Have been so for 35 years with a practice that emphasizes estate planning and probate. This bill was originally my proposal to the estate planning and administration section for their support. And so I take responsibility for the error that I'm about to explain to you that will lead to the Dash 2 amendments, I hope, that will be available for work session in a few weeks. In my written testimony, I explain at some length in detail, which I'm not going to read, the parallel tracks that general civil procedure and probate procedure followed since the 1862 Oregon Civil Code. The general civil practice departed from the old tradition with the adoption of the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure in 1979. Those of us practicing before then well remember that every time we filed a complaint in court, it had to be verified, and the statute specified that verified meant supported by an affidavit under oath or affirmation, which meant in practical terms we needed a notary. The legislature decided in 1979 that that procedure was unnecessary in general civil procedure, but didn't look at the parallel procedure in probate courts where verification is still required. And the initial purpose of the bill is to conform probate procedure in that regard to general civil procedure and eliminate a great deal of unnecessary notarization of documents under oath or affirmation. And I explain on the second page of my testimony what is supposed to be involved in administering an oath or affirmation and what in reality is not happening in law office and banks today. And my general view is that we shouldn't have laws that people are massively not following. It's not good for the legal system. It's not good for the democratic system to do that. So we're proposing to substitute a system that eliminates the notary, has a declaration under oath or affirmation, which has the same legal effect, but not the formality of the presence of the notary raising the right hand and so forth that's described on page 2 of my testimony. As Mr. Wachter indicated, at the same time, when I'm amending a section, as I was in Section 2 of the bill of the probate code, and there's an obvious error in the section as compared to practice, I can't keep my hands off it, and so I added a second purpose to the bill. Excuse me. and that was to correct the practice with regard to what we call short-form final accounts, so that the account which is supposed to allege that all creditors are paid, that all was asked for the payment of the fees of one or two more creditors, the personal representative and the attorney for the personal representative, that we simply put an exception in there saying that these administrative expenses need not be paid so that you can use the short-form final account. There are two amendments for the committee to consider. One is already before you, merely moves the declaration of under penalty of perjury in the bill up in front of the signature line. It was accidentally placed below the signature line where the old verification used to be. The second is somewhat more significant. A copy of the proposed amendment is attached to my testimony, and hopefully you'll have it before you for the work session in a few weeks. As originally proposed, the bill would have eliminated virtually all requirements for notarization of documents in probate. The Executive Committee of the Estate Planning and Administration section balked at a couple of aspects of that. In other words, the original bill would have followed the approach of the current Uniform Trial Court rules in saying that wherever the probate code says affidavit, that means declaration under penalty of perjury. The committee felt that should not be done in two areas, and those two areas are small estate affidavits and affidavits of witnesses to wills. They felt that we should continue with notarization of those two particular instruments, and so the bill does not address those. And I won't go into the reasons for their concern, but that we should generally follow the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure with respect to purely court procedure matters. And the bill addressed that with respect to verification, but did not address that with respect to one other area, and this is my fault because I left it out, and that is certificates of service. Right now, in many places in the probate code, you're required to have an affidavit of service. That means when I'm working on the weekend at the office and mailing a bunch of stuff out, I can't mail the documents to the court because I don't have a notary there to verify my signature on the affidavit of service. In the 1979 Rules of Civil Procedure, that requirement was eliminated for general civil procedure, again, for the reasons, the problems with notarization explained on page 2 of my testimony, decided it's unnecessary there. It is equally unnecessary in the probate context, and what hopefully will be the Dash 2 amendments will do is to conform that part of probate rule to general civil procedures. Thank you, members of the committee, for your consideration.
Are there any questions for either of these witnesses today, recognizing that because there are some Dash 2 amendments being prepared, that this bill will be coming back to a work session at a later time, if there's any uncertainty about this? Represented by Meech.
Thank you. You said that there were two areas where you were going to leave the notarization, and that one of them was witnessing wills, and I'm sorry, I missed the other one.
The other one's the small estate affidavit, which will remain an affidavit. And it was a concern of the banking industry that they wanted to see notarization on these instruments when they're presented to them to close out a bank account.
Thank you.
Any further questions? If not, then thank you, gentlemen, for coming back a second time. I realize it wasn't it was a long way to come for a fairly short time, but we do appreciate the input. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2362. And as indicated earlier, we're going to jump ahead on the agenda to House Bill 2514. Councilor Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The committee. House Bill 2514 requires tri-month bus drivers, train operators, trolley car operators, and station supervisors to call 911 before contacting the mass transit system dispatch operator when an emergency arises on the vehicle or other equipment used to move passengers. Chair, members of the committee, you have the Dash 1 amendments in front of you.
We have Senator Mona Sanderson here to present today, and we also have our first witness, Dara Sturdy. Would it be appropriate for both of you to come together, or
one. And Representative, oh, there he is. Representative Lim, I beg your pardon. So maybe the two of you to come up initially, Representative Lim and Senator Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it on?
Yes.
Yes. Good morning. It's so nice to see you in that position, Representative McPherson. I'm Senator Lori Mona Sanderson, and I represent Gresham, Wood Village, Troutdale, and Fairview, and I'm here to testify on Senate Bill 2514. Darla Sturdy, this request came to Representative Flores, Representative Lim, and myself. And Darla Sturdy is here because my staff talked with her, so hopefully by the time we're done, she will be here. The sole purpose of this legislation is to save lives. As a nurse, and I'm sure as you know, minutes can make the difference between life and death. And we want to make sure that when a pedestrian or a bicyclist is hit by a train, that 911 is called immediately. Minutes can make a difference between whether someone lives or someone dies. Darla Sturdy, she lives in my district, and Representative Lynn's district, has a tragic story to tell you, but it will let you know how important this piece of legislation is. She lost her son as he was riding his bike. He was drawn under the train where he suffocated, and a bystander held his hand while he died. And the particulars of the story will be addressed by Ms. Sturdy. Also, though, in the course of this testimony, I think it is extremely important for the committee to get or ask TriMet for some particular information regarding accidents involving TriMet buses and trains. I truly feel that we need to know how many accidents are involved with trains and how many accidents are involved with the buses. I also think we need to know the protocol. We need to know the protocol that they use when accidents happen. And we need to know the time frame of when dispatch is called to the time when 911 is called. We need to know that they use that protocol and whether or not they have done a safety study. It would be nice to know if a safety study, if they routinely do an analysis of accidents and safety, and if we as a legislature could have access to those documents. Thank you very much for hearing me.
Representative Lim.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, and members of this committee. Glad to see you here. My name is John Lim, for the record, from the District 50, which is Gresham area. And the person, Dallas Sturdy Wagner, is from my district. And I met her about a month ago and heard of this issue of calling the 911 instead of a next line operator. According to their procedure, in case there's an accident, I have here step one, train operator calls the rail controller via radio. Second step, train operator state that call is a priority call and gives specific information. Step three, rail controller stops train movement in the area as a safety precaution. Step four, controller calls 911. This is the current procedure. Maybe there might be a reason to do that, which I understand, since max line moving that the both directions in case a certain place there's an accident, max line must be stopped, which is very important, and it should be done in a timely manner, because sometimes a train carries about sometimes a maximum 300 people at one time, which I understand. But at the same time, when there is an accident, life in danger, on the street, it is also equally or more important to call 911. It is not just a matter of minutes, sometimes it's just a matter of seconds to save lives. I have some information given to me that the since June 23, 2003, five people have been killed by the MAX train accident, and then 10 people got, some of them are seriously injured and hit by the MAX train. So this accident happened about the 15 times out of 10 times out of 15 we have lost five, and including the two wheelchair people crossing that next line, which is very dangerous. The mother of this young child, 17 years old, and his name is Aaron Study Wagner. He was a high school student of my district. He was crossing the next line by bike, and he was hit, and he was killed. So what she's trying to do, not her own sons to save it at this time. She want to make sure these things doesn't happen again for other children or any other citizens in our state. And I met her several occasions. She is a man of lady, a wonderful lady, and the suffering she had in the past, last 4 years, who lost her dear son, is unimaginable. And she wants to change a law, make sure when such things happens, call 911. I'm not an expert on that issue, but as a common sense, 911 is the most hotline that saves lives. So to me, it is a prudent and appropriate way to call 911 first instead of calling their own controller. When they are calling their own controller, it is in their own hands. So by the third party, which is the 911, I believe is the most appropriate way to call to save lives and the future prevention in the future. Thank you very much for hearing my testimony.
And Chair McPherson, Ms. Sturdy is in the building, and unfortunately we probably didn't tell her how to get to this, how to get here. So we're still working. So you may have to go into recess at this point.
Right. I think I'd like to hear from her next. I would note for the record that Representative Flores is also a chief sponsor of this bill. She's excused for the day because her husband's having back surgery, but she would have liked to have been here to present on this bill as well. Committee, while we're waiting, are there any questions of these witnesses? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony, Senator Montes Anderson and Representative Lim. And this is a question that I'm sure I'll ask TriMet when and if they appear. But do you happen to know how frequently the trains come through the place where Ms. Sturdy's son was killed? What's the time lag between trains? And I know it probably differs
During rush hour, it's like every 5 to 7 minutes. And then during the rest of the day, since I use MAX quite frequently, it's about every 15 minutes.
Thank you.
Okay, if I may add that what I heard from his mother, he thought one train passed, it was okay. He tried to cross it, and he was hit. And so sometimes it's not a matter of how many, 5 minutes or 15 minutes. Sometimes it passes in a couple seconds, or 1 minute later, it just passes another line. So that's what happened. And Mr. Chair, if I may, can I go and look around of this lady?
That would be fine. Why don't we go into recess here for a couple minutes while we locate Ms. Curry? Could you come to the witness table? Start out by identifying yourself for the record.
My name is Darla Sturdy.
Just sit down and speak into the microphone and just identify yourself for the record there.
Okay. My name is Darla Sturdy.
Okay. And we've already heard from Senator Montes Anderson and Representative Lim about the bill and a bit about the tragedy that happened in your family. Why don't you just give us that description from your perspective about this bill?
Like many of you, I have a family that I deeply care about and means more to me than anything. Maybe you or someone you know has lost someone close, such as a family member. I lost my son. God blesses many families with children for you to take care of, to love them, to teach them, but not to outlive them. My son had so many great qualities, though I will only touch on a few. He started baseball at the age of 5 and played 9 years. He began Taekwondo at the age of 8, and at the age of 9, he was in the Junior Olympics and placed 4th in the nation. He started football in the 5th grade and played for 6 years. In middle school, he played basketball, did track, and also wrestling, placing 1st in many tournaments. Student body president his 8th grade year and 2 years of drama in high school. His last year of life, him and his sister became the first brother and sister of Gresham High School to ever make state and drama at the same time. He also placed 4th for Mr. Gresham at his high school sophomore year. He was involved in church youth group every Wednesday night and at a high school Christian group called Soul Food. My son's name is Aaron Wagner Sturdy. He'd be the first one to tell you, do for others before yourself. Very compassionate, full of love, and would always tell his mom, I'll never move away, until one day you get a knock on your door and they tell you your son will never come home again. My son was headed home on his dad's bike after spending the day talking to the youth group and witnessing to friends about God and church camp. I live in Gresham, the first place they started the MAX line. Where my son was killed, there was used to be no city hall, no mall, and a lot less people. TriMet built a train that runs through our city and gates and lights in place to protect the automobiles, but nothing to protect the pedestrian. After my son died, I wanted to know more about what exactly had happened. I read through everything I could, the police reports, TriMet reports, and the coroner's report. In going through these records, I found out that the driver of the train had called TriMet Dispatch first, before 911. Next, I took a closer look to how my son had died. He died of suffocation. My son was alive under the train. Every second went by, every minute that was wasted while the driver spoke to dispatch could have made a difference between the life and death of my son. If you were the driver of the train and you hit a child, would you have called dispatch or 911 first? Drivers for TriMet are required to call dispatch first in the event of an accident, be it a train, a bus, or a van. I'm here as a mom who doesn't want another parent or family to go through what we have. We have built the red line, the yellow line, the blue line, and TriMet keeps building. Yet who's going to make it safe for the people? Since my son's death, I've kept track by listening and being told of death and maimed people. If calling 911 had been a priority, maybe some of these lives could have been saved. I cannot bring my son back from heaven, but I can help make it safe for you and your family. Remember, I will never get to tell my son I love him or hold him each night when I come home. But with this bill, you will always be able to do that for your child and your family. Please make this a law, and you will save lives. May God be with all of you as you make this decision. My son had a saying, dream big. Don't ever let the little things get in your way. To me, that means, it's okay, Mom. You can't save me, but you can save someone else. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sturdy. Members, we were passed out sort of introductory material here from Vicki Olson. Is Ms. Olson in the room? I'm sorry, we didn't get a chance to bring you on before Ms. Sturdy. Did you don't want to come and say anything here? Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Sturdy, I want to say I'm so sorry for your loss, and thank you. I know it's hard for you to come here and talk about such a personal thing, but thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chair, follow up. Also, Ms. Sturdy, you talked about another bill that you have. I wonder if you could tell us about that, too, so that we're looking at the big picture.
The other bill is for pedestrian gates all the way down the line. There are several places where the pedestrian walks are that there aren't anything. And I think what's happened is when they first started making the line, like in Gresham, is it was all fields. And so what you've done is you've ran the train, and then we've built around it, but we haven't made it safe for the pedestrians. And so there's different places, and as you can see, one of the places I show you is by a school. So there's other places just like that.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Chair.
Representative Krieger.
Carl, what was the time lapse? You and I talked, but I didn't get the time lapse between the time of the accident and actually receiving medical help at the scene. Do we know a time lapse there?
Well, my son was alive under the train, and they actually had him hooked up to an IV, and then they had to back the train back up over him. And the time lapse, I couldn't tell you exactly. I mean, between the time that it happened and that they got there, I couldn't tell you exactly, no.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, darling. Do you know, did the dispatcher, the TriMet dispatcher call 911, or did somebody else call 911?
Well, the driver of the train called the dispatcher, and according to, that's all that I know in the police report, and then the dispatcher dispatches from there. And if you look through the four steps that are there, she apparently calls, for as far as the train goes, to stop the trains that are in that area for safety purposes, but I would hope that they have a system set up in case their own driver had a heart attack that they would know where the trains are.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Ms. Sturdy, thank you very much for coming in, and I know we know how hard it is for you, but we appreciate the energy and passion that you've brought to this issue.
Well, thank you all very much for listening to me today.
Very good. We have Olivia Clark next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Olivia Clark. I'm the Government Affairs Director for TriMet in Portland, and I appreciate the opportunity to offer some testimony here today on House Bill 2514, which would require TriMet operators to directly contact 911 in the event of an emergency. Intuitively, I think you and I as citizens all, when we witness an emergency or are involved in one, know to call 911 immediately, and we trust that they'll be there to assist us as soon as possible. For a TriMet rail operator who is operating a MAX train, the situation is very different. The MAX train is carrying as many as 300 passengers, followed by another MAX train carrying passengers, and faced with a MAX train approaching on the opposite track. An emergency must be handled in a coordinated fashion to avoid the potential for increased threat to the hundreds of people on the train and to the train operator. Without coordination, the emergency can escalate and the response time can be delayed. MAX train operators are equipped with a radio that connects directly and immediately to the TriMet Control Center. The Rail Control Center electronically tracks the location of every train in the entire system on a multi-million dollar overhead display board, and at any moment, the Control Center knows the location of every train. The Control Center itself has a direct link to 911 that ensures location accuracy and a timely response by emergency personnel. This direct ring down line means that TriMet does not wait in a queue of 911 public calls, but has an immediate link. In addition, the 911 center cannot determine the exact location of a TriMet train. The control center must also avoid the endangerment of hundreds of other train passengers by alerting every train in the area. If there is an emergency incident on the train right of way, the operator or any other emergency responder must not be placed in danger by an oncoming train. In 2009, the TriMet rail system is going to be working with three different 911 centers in the region. Relying on an operator who is involved in an incident to determine and find the correct 911 center could well slow a response. And in the early stages of an emergency, the rail operator may not always be able to precisely indicate their proper direction or location. House Bill 2514 moves TriMet away from the best practices of the transit industry and would weaken the safety of the regional rail system. TriMet actively participates in the American Public Transit Association Standards Program, and moves its procedures and practices into alignment with the best safety and operational practices of the industry. In addition, TriMet has an annually updated system safety program plan that is required and reviewed by the the Federal Transit Administration. Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to answer any questions that you may have to the best of my ability. I'm not in a position to discuss the situation of this particular case because it is in the courts. Thank you.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How would an operator call 911 directly?
They would have to have a cell phone. Mr. Chairman, excuse me, Representative Barker. They can't do that on their TriMet radio. They would have to have a cell phone, and they're not allowed to have cell phones on the train. It's a matter of having a distraction the 23 hours of the rest of the day.
Okay, and just if I may add a comment to that, at one time during my past life, I was the sergeant in charge of the 911 center in Portland, and sometimes when something would happen, you get a bunch of calls come in at one time, and they would actually overload, and so people would get a recording saying stay on the line and all that, and it would delay sometimes reporting other incidences. And I'd like to ask if you know, if I'm the train operator and I'm in action, I call dispatch and say I've just run over somebody, priority call, how long does it take them? They shut down the trains. How long does it take for me saying I run over somebody till when they hit 911?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker, I have to check with dispatch. I don't know the precise time. I'm not sure if it may be simultaneous, but I'd have to check. And I'm happy to bring other witnesses either from the dispatch center or the 911 center to answer additional questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Clark. I don't know if you answered this my question in response to Representative Barker's question, so I'm going to follow up just a little bit. I have something that has your name on it that's a summary of rail control procedures for accidents from June of 05 that talks about when a serious accident occurs on the MAX, the train operator immediately calls the rail controller. The train operator would state that it's a priority call and give specific information. And then the controller would stop train movement in the area as a safety precaution and then call 911. And I guess my question is, not necessarily with regard to this case, but even hypothetically, could that be done simultaneously?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bonamici, I'm going to have to check with dispatch to find out how they actually do that, how they implement the standard operating procedures, because I do not know the answer to that question.
Follow-up?
You may. Please.
Thank you. And Ms. Clark, in this particular area where Ms. Sturdy's son was killed, how frequently do the trains come through there? And I know it differs based on what time of day it is.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bonamici, at peak time, they can run more frequently than every 15 minutes. In fact, there may be trains that get down to 10 minutes, in some cases even less time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Ms. Clark, is there technology that tells the dispatch center precisely the location of the train, or does the dispatch center rely on the operator informing the dispatch center of where the train is located?
Mr. Chairman, the rail dispatch center has an overhead board with lights on it of the entire system that shows the precise location of each train. So the rail control and dispatch center would be able to identify exactly where that train is when the call comes in.
So as between the operator on the train making a direct contact with 911 and the dispatch center, who could give more accurate location information to 911 about where the event had occurred?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would have to say the rail control center, particularly if there is an incident or an emergency situation that is in between stations or somewhere where an operator who themselves may be in shock may have difficulty in actually relaying where the specific location is. In addition, the rail dispatch and control center can actually provide information on the best access to those places for the 911 emergency vehicles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mrs. Clark, thanks for your testimony. And I understand emergency reaction, I think, from my background pretty well. But when did you know about this bill coming up, and why doesn't Trimex have an alternative to offer us today?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wisnett, I actually did not know about the bill until Friday afternoon. I apologize for not having additional expert testimony here. As far as I'm perfectly willing to work with the committee on an alternative, very willing to. In fact, I have talked to one of the bill's sponsors about that very thing. I apologize for being caught quickly on the hearing.
One more.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Clark, in that step of stopping train movement, how long does that take? Is it a button to push or a call to make, or how, logistically, how is that done?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bonamici, I'm not an operator. I have been in the cab. I know that there is a device that they control the speed with. When they're coming into a station, they're decelerating. There is also a button in the train itself that you or I could hit in the emergency situation, which immediately will stop the train. But you're talking about a train car that weighs about 90 tons that's going to take a little more room to stop. I can't tell you the stopping distance per se. Again, I can bring someone here that can talk about the stopping distance.
Sorry if that wasn't clear. I was talking about how long would it take the rail controller to get the message to the trains that are incoming. How long does that process take if the rail controller needs to take the time to stop the other trains? How long does that actually take?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bonamici, I'm going to have somebody from the rail control center or dispatch to actually precisely indicate how long a phone call or a radio call takes to each train to stop them. I don't know what the answer is to that question.
Thank you.
Representative Trump.
Thanks, Chair McPherson. Ms. Clark, could you put down on the questions to be answered? We have testimony that several people have died in the last 3 to 4 years. Could you have them describe for us what is a debriefing after such an incident? What does that look like, and what recommendations has the group that goes through a critical debrief like this? That would be appreciated.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cobb, absolutely.
Thank you.
Representative Burke.
Mr. Chair, if I may take the liberty to... Ms. Clark, it's also a bill, kind of a companion bill requiring gates. And so when that one comes up, I would hope you have enough advance notice to bring people in so that would know, be able to give us some things like, I'm sure the cost would be of concern to comment, but then let us know how the gates that are in place in some place, like I know at the Beaverton Transit Center, they have gates. If you could just have us a little more information when it comes up, thank you.
If there are no further questions, then we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2514. We'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 2233.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2233. Let me get to my staff members on that. And the committee allows the Department of Revenue to record with the Department of Consumer and Business Affairs a lien for deferred taxes on manufactured home, clarifies the department has a lien not only for deferred taxes but also interest in the deferred taxes, allows the Department of Revenue to record with the Secretary of State's office a lien for deferred taxes on a floating home. Chairman of the committee, you have someone here from the Department of Revenue to testify.
And I see also we have John Phillips in the Department of Revenue. If he could come forward. And I see we also have Joan Fraser from DCBS signed up as well. And it might be efficient if both of those came forward together here. Mr. Phillips.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, excuse me, my name is John Phillips with the Oregon Department of Revenue. Thank you for hearing this bill today. We have a property tax relief program known as the Senior and Disabled Deferral Program, and that program is self-funding. And the way it works is that seniors or disabled individuals apply for the program, and a lien is placed on their property, and at such time as they either pass away or sell the property or refinance, the monies advanced by the Department of Revenue that exists in this fund are then returned to the fund. So it's self-funding. We advance the money, they pay it back. The critical component to this process to make sure that the program is self-funding is this lien. The lien works really well on real property because property liens are filed in the county, and as you know, that works for title companies to pick up. On personal property, however, and there are some cases where people have manufactured structures, and on those personal properties, in the past, they were issued titles from the Department of Motor Vehicles. They were known as they were a vehicle. And any time you went to apply for a title change or refinance, that title then, the information would be picked up through the Department of Motor Vehicles. Well, that whole system transferred in May of 2005. It went from motor vehicles to DCBS, or Department of Consumer and Business Services. They track the information now on what's called an ownership document. So we no longer have license plates on manufactured structures that are sitting on land and people are actually living in a vehicle. So these ownership documents, the way we get our lien on that information and we're sure to be paid has been a little bit unclear. And so we are not, the Department of Revenue is not showing up as a secured interest holder on that ownership document. So our objective with this bill is simply to ensure that when we file our lien, it is recorded as a security interest on that ownership document that's that the Department of Business and Consumer Services are used to handling for any other security interest holder like banks or mortgage companies. So that's the purpose of the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Councilor Taylor.
Mr. Phillips, could you tell us when a manufactured home is treated as real property as opposed to personal property?
Yes, I'd be happy to, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Taylor. A real property manufactured structure can be considered real property whenever the ownership of the land on which it's sitting and the manufactured structure itself is the same individual or the same parties own that manufactured structure and the land.
Thank you.
Otherwise, it's considered personal property. There was a change to the law in, I believe it was 2003, that also opened that up for anybody that has a 20-year lease on the land. And I think the real idea there was that if you have a 20-year lease, you're going to be there for a long time. There's not a movement situation with the manufactured structure. And it also gives the homeowner an opportunity to get better financing. So those are the only situations that I'm aware of for him.
Thank you.
Certainly.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you talk about the tax structure, a follow-up to Council's question? If the same piece of property was personal property versus real property, how's the tax different or the fees are different?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, the taxes are the same on real versus personal property. Any property within a county or within a tax code area that's served by cities or the county, obviously, a library district, park and recreation district, or a fire district, their tax rates are applied against the physical area in which that property is located. So whether it's personal or real property is not really critical to the determination of the actual tax. However, on the collection side, when you go to collect on the property, there's a bit of a difference because on real property you can foreclose and on personal property you have to seize it. So there are issues with that, but those don't necessarily come into this particular bill. I hope that answers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Phillips, prior to the change in law in 2003 that apparently went into effect in 2005, was this tax deferral program working fine for manufactured homes, and this is just a clarification of prior procedure and policy, or is this changing the actual policy of the tax deferral program for people who have manufactured homes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, the latter of what you said. The system worked the way it worked, and we were able to perfect our lien then, but then there's been this period of time where it's been in question. So we're trying to return the system to the way it was back prior to the switch over from the Department of Motor Vehicles.
Thank you.
Now, Mr. Phillips, all the discussion has been on here on manufactured homes, but I see a reference in the staff measure summary to floating homes. Are they just basically another version of the same thing for these purposes?
Mr. Chair, the answer to that question, I believe, is that floating homes are recorded, and I've got some more questions. They're recorded with the Secretary of State, and so in some of the text you'll see, such as on page 2, there's references in line 23 to the Secretary of State and line 39, and that's because for the few floating homes that we do have that are under senior or disabled deferral, and I mean very few, that picks up those situations. All we're trying to do is to make sure that regardless of the type of structure that these individuals are living in, we're at least able to recover the lien so that the program can continue to service other seniors and disabled people.
Okay. If there are no further questions, let's hear from Ms. Fraser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Joan Fraser, and I'm the Deputy Administrator of the Building Codes Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I'm here today to testify for the record that we are happy to work with the Department of Revenue to administer the provisions of this bill. However, we do have a concern with Section 5, which is the implementation date. We would like to be able to move that back and just actually remove Section 5 so that it's effective January. That gives us some time to make some programming changes that are necessary in order for us to administer the program. We also have another bill coming down the pike in the Senate side that would require some changes in our system as well, so we want to be able to do it efficiently and do it all at the same time. So with your approval, we would respectfully request that we be able to amend the bill to eliminate Section 5. If that is not possible, we'd be happy to do that work with the Senate on the Senate side as the bill moves through the process. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Ms. Fraser? Representative Cameron.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Fraser, how many homes are we talking about that this would impact that your department?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, I don't have that information. I'm thinking perhaps Mr.
There's somebody else who could join these witnesses?
From the Department of Revenue.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, that's about 1,400 manufactured structures.
Just a clarification.
Okay.
That are in the deferral program that are considered personal property, 1,400?
Mr. Chair, yes. Representative Cameron.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Phillips, do you have any objection to removing Section 5?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, thank you for the question. No, we're fine with that. Whatever it takes to administer.
Mr. Phillips, is there any concern about having manufactured homes in the deferral program? Because as a general matter, the theory of the deferral program is that there is value that will be realized ultimately, and so by having a lien on that piece of property, it will, the public jurisdiction is secured in its right to receive those tax monies down the road. But one of the realities of manufactured homes is that they're a depreciating asset. Do you have any experience with situations in which the manufactured home does not have sufficient value to cover the deferred tax bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't have any personal experience with specific situations, but I know that there are situations where both manufactured structures and the regular stick-built homes where the value starts to exceed the actual the actual deferred tax and interest starts to exceed the actual lien and equity in the home, if you will. Sometimes, and it's not that often, the person's on the program for a long time. Typically, a senior, the quote of the qualifications that they be 62 and that there's a means test so that they have an income level. And 62, and if they live till they're 100, that's a long time to be on the program. Fortunately, we were in a
situation where the market is increasing, and we haven't seen as much of that, but it can happen. Where we really think it might happen, and we've discussed this with the Revenue Committee in the past, is a situation where a disabled person enters the program. There's no age limit. So in the event a 30-year-old disabled person enters the program, that could happen. But it's not caused a problem in terms of the fund being able to sort of continue and self-fund. But there are isolated incidences.
Representative Wisdom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Phillips, if I'm not mistaken, this is the fund that we raided a couple of sessions ago, and in the last session we said that we're not going to do that and it's protected now in the future. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisdom, that was a fund that in Senate Bill 870 there was some money taken out of, yes, prior to it being committed to the Oregon Project Independence. Yes. About $27 million.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on, if I have a deferment and I'm deferring my taxes, does that account accumulate interest? I mean, so that would that help cover the like where the lines cross in the...
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, yes, exactly. It does accumulate interest, and that's part of why it's self-funding. It's only 6% interest, and it's simple interest. So it's not that much interest, but it's something that helps keep the money flowing to fund additional applicants.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Well, we have a request for an amendment to the bill that is apparently not resisted, so we won't be moving this to work session. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2233 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2492.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 2492 comes to you from Representative McPherson and Representative Wisnett. Allows a court to take a beneficiary's interest in retirement plan to satisfy a judgment for restitution in a criminal action if the beneficiary is convicted of a felony, the judgment is in favor of the defendant's employer, and three, the retirement plan was at least partially funded by contributions made by the employer.
Representative Wisnett, could you give the committee the background on this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and honorable committee members. Read from newspaper account USA Today, January the 24th. The House unanimously passed legislation that would deny congressional pensions to members of Congress who are convicted of crimes such as bribery, fraud, and perjury. The vote was 431-0. Committee members, also the Senate passed a bill, and there's a conference committee set up to work on this that would take away pensions of U.S. representatives who have committed these crimes. Let me give you a little history on this bill briefly. In my backyard in Deschutes County, we had a sheriff who from 1996 to 2000, and he was once voted Oregon Sheriff of the Year, stole over $555,000 in taxpayers' money. At the time of his sentencing, he repaid all the money he had stolen. I've come to learn that that's not exactly true. He plea bargained down to that. They had a record of over $1 million he'd stolen, and he paid $500,000. And this gentleman then went to prison. And after he was released from prison last year, he's now receiving PERS benefits, an extensive amount of PERS benefit. I don't have the actual amount. But I thought this was wrong. I served 27 years in the United States military. A military officer is always subject to double jeopardy. And I felt our elected officials and our public people on the public tax roll should be also held to a higher standard. So let me give you a little experience, especially to the first-term members of this committee. This bill passed out of the House. First, it came to the Chair Barker's committee last session and passed out of that committee and then the full Judiciary Committee. It went to the floor and passed 46-13. I think it's basically because of the great speech that the carrier presented on the floor. But that's a little
crazy. It was brilliant. I remember.
However, there was one member of this body who opposed it. And he gave a good speech, as he should, voicing his opposition to it. And that good representative, Chair McPherson, after the session said, "Gene, I think you have a good bill. I'd like to work with you, and let's refine it and make it a little better." The bill never got heard in the Senate, and that's a we can talk about that off the record, but it never received a committee hearing or a vote. It was a good bill. So again, a little bit of background. Let me tell you, again, especially for our new members, first-termers in this committee, I started off, my intent was to hold elected officials and people on the public payroll to this standard. Well, I was advised that, you know, that's not fair. We should look at also people in the private sector. Don't just hold public employees. Let's look at the private sector and see if we can, you know, some way their retirement is subject to some sort of repayment for restitution. So I worked that out. I went to PERS board. Originally, I was going to say you could take no more. You had to leave at least 25%, and it was only going to take that period of the time of the commission of the crime that the person was convicted of, not charged or anything, convicted of a felony. I was originally only going to take that period of the time money that he was doing the crime. Maybe the other time was good behavior. PERS board didn't want to be involved in this, and they said, no, let the judge, let's put it in the judicial system and look at the assets and the restitution involved. Let's don't make the PERS board in charge of doing that. So we worked all those compromises. So we made it not just for elected and public servants. We made it for anyone that's not subject to the protection of their retirement plan by federal law. So I've learned a lot in working this bill and things like that. So the bill that you have before you now with the co-sponsors' changes, I think it's a good bill. And let me see. And this is, again, I really feel strong about this. We're not going after, you know, just anyone. We're going after people that you paid to do a job. While they were doing that job, they were stealing from you. And not only were they stealing from you, they were getting retirement money that you're paying, the taxpayers are paying. So this bill allows the judicial system to look at that retirement fund that they've earned as part of the restitution to the employer, or could be public or private. So with those, Mr. Chairman, comments, I'll be briefer today than on the floor and hope that I'll be
quick. Thank you, Representative Wisnett. Representative Krieger.
I think most of us voted for that bill last time. I have a couple of things. Tell me how the judge deals with the family, a mortgage, and the person whose benefits were taken, then he dies, and the family member then is not able to, for instance, a wife, her husband dies after the money's been taken out, and let's say she's disabled. What does she do? She didn't commit any crime. I'm not certain how you can, is there some way the judge can protect her? The money's already been taken. And then he dies, and she doesn't have his retirement anymore.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, the procedure is in the courts. The courts would have to do that. They make the determination of restitution to the employer, if it's to the county or to the state, and they have to consider the, you know, that would be part of the testimony in making their ruling. As I said, my original bill protected a certain percentage of the retirement, but this bill leaves entirely up to the judge, and that would have to come forward. As we know from the recent case of the food procurement officer for DOC, his wife was involved. Greg Brown was not married. Michael Boyle, a state employee of this, who was funneling young boys to his friend who had a foster home and was abusing those child, he was not married. So.
I want to get back for some reason, that bill file I haven't got with me. I don't know how that happened, but I'm still concerned about the fact that the court makes a decision. Now, does that actually take the money out of that plan when that court does that, out of that person's retirement? And then, and the judge can't take into consideration that 2 weeks later the guy dies and the disabled wife has nothing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I would argue with you, sir, that if he cared about the family, he would not have committed the crime, or he would have taken insurance policy to protect his family. I have to take insurance policy to ensure that my family has part of my retirement, 55%, when I die.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for your testimony, Representative. I have a question. Well, you started out with the federal provisions, but I think you mentioned bribery, fraud, etc. This is any felony, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Representative Bonamici. Correct.
Thank you very much. And follow-up?
You may.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My other question is, you said that the hypothetical would be this is somebody who was stealing money while he was working for the employer. Could it be, I'm trying to read between the lines here, but could it be somebody who's retired and then goes out and commits a crime? Can they still get into the plan that way? Or does it have to be fraud or stealing during the time of employment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, it had to be during the time he was employed. If he was retired, it would not come into play.
Yeah, it would. It's limited to a case where there's a judgment of restitution running in favor of the employer. So it would be something that would arise out of the employment relationship that would give rise to a restitution judgment.
Mr. Chair, because the point here is he's being paid by either his employer, the private employer, or the state to steal. Now, if he's retired, and that's a different situation, but in this situation, he's being paid. We're paying him to steal, then he's getting money extra set aside for his retirement during the time that he's committing the felony, and it has to be convicted felony. So I think, again, I think we worked the bill. You know, it's not what I wanted when I started out, but I think with advice and trying to, you know, learn the process, I think we've got a bill that's fair. It's not just against the state employees or elected officials.
Representative Barker.
Thank you. My visioning of this is that I get, well, it wouldn't be me, but if Krieger gets convicted, we're retired, so it wouldn't matter anyway. But they wouldn't go to PERS and say, give me this guy's whole plan out of there. It would be out of the monthly payments. Is that correct? Is that how that would be paid back?
Mr. Chair and Representative Barker, I think you could, that would be set up, or the judge would have to set that up where it's a one-time or monthly, taking out. I think it depends. Again, I want it within the PERS system. It's not in the PERS system. PERS has nothing to do but pay the check when the judge rules now. It's not in the PERS system of how you're going to lose it.
Maybe Mr. Chris, you could answer. Can the judge tell PERS, give me all your money?
It's subject to execution on the... on whatever is payable, and so I think the best interpretation of it, although I think it's an interesting question that you raise it, is that it would only be couldn't be executed on except when it's payable under the terms of that system. So if the person was getting a monthly check, it would be each monthly check that would then go, instead of going from PERS to the former public employee, it would be going from PERS to the employer.
And follow up. A slightly different thing. This covers public employees, not the others. Private pensions are protected by ERISA. And
right. Why don't I elaborate on that a little bit, because that was one of the points of discussion when the prior version of the bill was proceeding 2 years ago. Under federal law, the ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, requires that employees' retirement benefits be protected from any kind of creditor, even the victim of a crime, which is what we're talking about here, as an employer who's the victim of the criminal conduct of the employee. And so it's not possible for us to give access by a private employer under an ERISA plan to those monies. So this would apply to public employees who are not subject to ERISA. It would also apply to executive plans that are not subject to that protection under ERISA. So those are the two categories that would be available to. It would be public employers could get this restitution judgment, or a private employer who's proceeding against an executive who had had a supplemental retirement plan or a deferred compensation plan or stock options, that kind of thing.
But when we say public employees, is this just PERS or does it go to there's a few non-PERS retirement systems?
It would be any governmental retirement plan.
System. Mr. Chair,
you read.
Go ahead. No.
Mr. Chair, I have a quick question that you might best be equipped to answer. You mentioned that the judgment might be executed against monthly payments, and that struck me that might also be somewhat responsive to what Representative Krieger was asking. So if a judgment was made, was then executed against monthly payments, person dies, does that judgment then stop and payments continue to heirs or survivors?
Well, it does occur to me, just as a result of this discussion here, that the bill could be amended to provide that it's only those payments that are being made to the individual, the person who committed the criminal act, and that a benefit that was payable to a spouse would not be executed on under this bill. Now, that wouldn't necessarily resolve the issue entirely because the classic kind of pension with survivor features is one that's payable entirely to the employee during the employee's life. And then if the spouse survives, then some portion of it, usually half, is payable to the spouse for the remainder of the spouse's life. So you still might have a situation where that spouse was depending upon that lifetime payment to the employee before the employee's death.
Mr. Chair, that could also happen also to someone, we think about maybe an older person, that you could have someone in their 30s, 40s have that and actually have children that would be very dependent on that. You might have kids in college, but now the fact that dad's a cull doesn't mean that you want them to suffer as a result of their father's conduct. I mean, we look around and see where kids are affected today by a whole host of things from parents, and I wouldn't want to add this to it the way it's written. I think there could be an amendment made specifically to state that it doesn't follow after the death of the person, that any benefit that was left would then be paid out of that, especially if it's a monthly payment.
Well, I think that's a good point. I think at its core, there's still the potential, regardless, that there may be innocent dependents of a wrongdoer that we would be giving access to the employer to recover from retirement assets, and those innocent dependents are going to lose their access to that source of support. So that's the fundamental policy choice here is we've got a wrongdoer, we don't want to protect the wrongdoer, but there may be innocent dependents of the wrongdoer.
And that, Mr. Chair, that dependents, if they aren't provided for, may be on, then qualify for public assistance.
Could be. Any further questions at this point? Then I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 20.
Could I just make one final comment? Again, people, we're talking about bad people here, and we're talking about taking away from them what either their employer, a private, or a state provided them to commit a felony. And so I just hope you'll remember that. If we're concerned about our ethics, that's our concern, and the public is concerned about our ethics. I don't think we need to be concerned about paying a big retirement to people who commit a felony while they're employed by us and using taxpayers' money or that company's money. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Wisnett. Let's close the public hearing on House Bill 2492. Members, that concludes our agenda today. We are adjourned.
Thank you.